This presentation was given at the 2017 Oktoberfest Conference at the Orangeburg German Swiss Genealogy Society. Rights to the content of the presentation remain with the speaker.
At this point, I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Robert Jones. I think many of you have probably already talked to him, but we'll hear more from him this evening. He served as the president of the Kennesaw Historical Society for 21 years and has also served as an executive board member of the Kennesaw Museum for 17 years, or the Museum Foundation. He has written 40-plus books on various historical topics, including South Carolina and Georgia in the American Revolution, and that's what he's going to speak to us tonight about. So please give him a big welcome.
I did want to add one thing. It's true I was president of the Kennesaw Historical Society for 21 years, but I wanted to point out it was not because I was such a great president, it's because nobody else wanted the job. And I'm guessing some of you may have been in that position from time to time in different organizations you belong to. I'll also mention, and this is something I don't normally tell people, but since this is the German-Swiss Genealogical Society, do I have it right? I have German heritage from kind of a different group of Germans than I think you do, which was the Mennonites who came to Pennsylvania. So I have Pennsylvania Dutch heritage. And so I know a little bit about what being German is, so I have some connection with you. So our topic today, I'm actually only going to do the South Carolina part, although the book also contains Georgia. Now, I will do a comparison from time to time, but mostly I'll be talking about South Carolina. The other book I have on South Carolina is a guide to the Civil War in South Carolina, and my table's right outside the door, and if you haven't already bought these, I'll be happy to sell you something after the dinner. I'll also be here tomorrow at 8:30, so I'll be here all day tomorrow. If you'd like me to sign your book, I'll be happy to. If you're more likely to buy it, if I promise never to sign it, that's okay also. And everything's $10. You can give me cash and make your change. You can give me a check. I can take a credit card. So, South Carolina. Unlike Georgia, which I will tell you about in a moment, South Carolina got involved in the Revolution from a political standpoint pretty early in the game. First Continental Congress, 5 South Carolina Carolinians attended, as opposed to, you want to know how many people Georgia sent to the First Continental Congress? It would be zero, none at all. And then Georgia, it took them a while to send anybody to the Second Continental Congress. And the guy who eventually went, Lyman Hall, it wasn't Georgia that sent him, it was the parish or the county that he lived in. So he gets up to Philadelphia and he announces, well, I'm here from Georgia, St. John's Parish. And they said, oh, thank heaven, we finally have somebody from Georgia. And he said, no, I'm not representing Georgia, I'm representing St. John's Parish. So they actually had to go into session to decide whether they should give this guy a vote or not, since he wasn't there recognizing Georgia. So, as I said, I was going to do a little bit of comparison, and I wanted you to know that you guys were way ahead of your neighbor to the south and to the west. June 1775, the South Carolina provincial government begins forming the General Assembly of South Carolina. So, more and more in this period, you see different colonies trying to establish their own government that had nothing to do with the British. September 1775, Royal Governor Lord William Campbell leaves Charlestown for the British warship Tamar. He never returns. As a matter of fact, in 12 of the colonies, once the British governor was kicked out, they never came back. Would anybody like to guess what the one colony was where the governor came back? It was Georgia! November 19th, 1775, Patriot militia fights loyalists in the first battle of 96, resulting in the first colonial death in South Carolina. December 3rd, 1775, Don't Travel Me flag designed by Christopher Gadsden of the Continental Congress is flown on the Alfred in South Carolina. Okay, there's somebody that I'm guessing most of you recognize, since half of the towns and whatnot in South Carolina are named after him. June 28, 1776, kind of an amazing thing happens, and that's really early in the war, if you think about it. And Moultrie kicks the British's butt in Charleston. And Britain is considered the greatest navy in the world at the time, and Moultrie defeats them. It's really an astonishing story, and I'll talk a little more about it in a moment. But the British are under General Henry Clinton, who eventually will be the head of all British forces in America. So I guess after Clinton got clobbered by Moultrie in Charleston, the British decided to promote him. That happened a lot at the company I used to work for. You get promoted after you do something incompetent. But that's another story. July 4, 1776, Declaration of Independence is adopted. You got four people from South Carolina who signed it. There were three from Georgia. Again, doing a comparison, one of the three from Georgia who signed it was named Button Gwinnett. Some of you may have heard of Gwinnett County. And soon after he signed it, he died in a pistol duel with the head of the Georgia militia. Now, if you want to think of the most stupid, horrifying thing you could do in the middle of a war, you take your political head, Button Gwinnett was head of the assembly in Georgia, and your militia head, and you have the two of them shoot at each other. I mean, why not? Isn't it fun comparing South Carolina to Georgia? Okay, so Moultrie's defense on Sullivan's Island. So this is probably an idealized drawing of what the original fort looked like. But you're all probably familiar with the story. The original fort was made of palmetto logs with sand and whatnot in between it. And it worked out so well because the British cannonballs would hit it, and the palmetto logs, instead of splintering, would just go wall. And it really helped save Charleston. So, again, this is probably a little idealized as to what it looked like. And here's Charlestown after the war started. The colonials changed it to Charleston because they didn't want to emphasize the king's name on the same slide. So, I know you probably can't see this real well, but I can show you a couple things. So, this is Sullivan's Island, Charleston. Here's Moultrie's Fort, which wasn't called Fort Moultrie yet. but I'm going to call it Fort Moultrie. So Fort Moultrie's here. Here's Charleston's up there. Now, you're probably all familiar with the fact that Charleston's a tricky harbor because of the sandbars and whatnot. So you kind of have to know what you're doing to get in. The British being, this may shock you, being slightly arrogant, thought they got no problem. We have the best sailors in the world. We're just going to come blast into the harbor. No problems here. So the British fleet comes up here. Well, where's Moultrie have his fort? Right where the British are coming around the sandbar here. So Moultrie just blasted them from his fort. Now, there's a funny part to this also. The British thought they were going to do a sea and a land attack. And the land attack was they were going to land on this island, and then they thought the water was shallow enough that their soldiers would be able to walk from here to here. So they had their soldiers line up and they started walking, and when they were down to their caps, they decided to abandon that, so there never was a land attack against Moultrie at Fort Moultrie. So it was a total catastrophe for the British. They lost a couple of their ships and they had to retreat. Now these are actually replica 18-pounders, but this is exactly, these were made in 1776 for the Bicentennial. This is what the fortifications, or what the cannon that Moultrie had on Sullivan's Island would have looked like. And if you go out to Fort Moultrie today expecting to find the Revolutionary War fort, it ain't there. It's long ago washed away. Fort Moultrie today is really a World War II fort. I mean, that's what's left. But these cannons mark where Moultrie's fort was. And he's buried there. How many people knew Moultrie was buried at Fort Moultrie? Isn't that cool? Well, some of you knew. And that's the flag he designed, which there are elements of that flag in the South Carolina flag today. Okay, July 1776, the Cherokees start attacking the colonials, and they're instigated by the British. So the colonials are not just fighting the British now, they're fighting the Indians. And while this was not a major fight, you have to put some stuff in presentations that are cool, even if they weren't that important. And this is cool, because Andrew Pickens, and no image of him smiling has ever been made. He looks like that in everything. I have a 6-year-old granddaughter that has that look on her face all the time. He was a great general. I'm not trying to put him down, but he didn't seem very happy. So August 12, 1776 is something called the Ring Fight. So his troops, he's got about 25 troops, and they get surrounded by 185 Cherokee Indians. So what he does is he makes a double ring, an inner ring and an outer ring. So when his troops fire, they're firing in all directions and they're surrounded. And he actually holds them off long enough until his brother shows up with reinforcements. Isn't that cool? Isn't that brilliant? He's outnumbered, 7-1? And he holds them off because of this cool ring he creates. Woo-hoo! February 5th, 1778, South Carolina ratifies the Articles of Confederation, and it's the first state to do so. February 3rd, 1779, now Major General Moultrie, you'll notice he went up several ranks after he beat the British at the Sullivan's Island battle, defeats the British at Port Royal Island. June 20th, 1779, British victory at the Battle of Stone of Ferry, west of Charleston. There is General Benjamin Lincoln. And some of you are probably descended from him, so I shouldn't say something like this, but he doesn't look like the most inspirational figure of the war, does he? But at this point, 1780, he's in charge of the Southern Command. Washington always liked this guy. As a matter of fact, at Yorktown, when the British surrendered their sword, Washington wouldn't accept. He told him to give it to Benjamin Lincoln. So Washington always liked the guy. Now, all that being said, just in case you're descended from him, May 12, 1780, the British defeat Benjamin Lincoln at Charleston. Probably, it's certainly in the top five military disasters in American history. 5,266 colonials are captured. Washington could not afford to have 5,000 men captured. So it's a total defeat. And this is when Lord Cornwallis, once he gets Charleston, he now invades the center part of South Carolina. And we'll look at a map in a moment. I'll tell you a little more about that. But kind of coupled with this, a mere, 2.5 weeks later, the last of the Continental Army left in South Carolina, most of them were captured here in Camden. The last of the Continental Army in South Carolina, they're trying to escape the state, get out of here, get away from Cornwallis. They are mowed down at Waxhaw Creek by British Colonel Banaster Tarleton. I'll pause a moment in case anyone wants to hiss. And it appears he may have ordered the killing of the colonial prisoners. And even in his journal, as you read his account of the battle, he said, you know, the funny thing is, I fell off my horse, and when I got back up again, my men were stabbing all of the prisoners to death. I don't know what happened. Well, did everything stop it, big boy? So whether he actually ordered it or not, he didn't attempt to stop it. Now, supposedly, when his men saw him fall off the horse, he thought that one of the colonials had shot the horse. And so they were mad about that. But he didn't. He fell off. And whether that caused a massacre or not, I don't know. But I do know the colonial head was Buford, a guy named Buford. And that became a rallying cry from that point on, is remember Waxhaw Creek, remember Buford. Okay, the Charleston Siege. Now, the British mama didn't raise no fools with the British. So after having gotten spanked so bad at Fort Moultrie, when they attacked Charleston this time, they stayed as far away from across the bay as possible, and they landed at Fort Johnson. And they sent their troops all the way around here with James Island, and you know what the traffic's like on James Island. It must be brutal getting the British forces around there. And they came all the way around here, and it came out of the Pinoy Peninsula. You can't really see it on this map, but there are red lines here. And by that time, they had engulfed the city. So they had completely surrounded it, and that's why Lincoln had to surrender. Only one good thing came out of it. Francis Marion had broken his ankle a few days before Charleston surrendered. So the colonials had gotten Marion out of the city so that he could recover. So the British, they captured Moultrie, they captured Lincoln, the whole thing. They didn't capture Francis Marion. So even when they had either captured or slaughtered the Continental Army in South Carolina, for the next year, there was still a fighting, colonial fighting force, and it was Francis Marion, the smallpox. Clinton just couldn't keep his mouth shut. June 3rd, 1780, British General Henry Clinton dictated that all colonial POWs in South Carolina either take up arms against their comrades or be charged with treason. And he went even further. He said he was going to go into the villages and he was going to shoot people unless they joined the militia and all this. He didn't understand Americans. How many people think that would scare the Americans into joining the militia? No, it ticked them off. It ticked off the Americans. And it directly led to the defeat of the British at Kings Mountain. And I'll talk about why in a moment. Colonial victory at Hanging Rock, August 6, 1780. And then, you know, Benjamin Lincoln's gone, and Washington puts Horatio Gates in charge of the Southern Command. Now, Horatio Gates is the guy who supposedly won the great battle at Saratoga in New York. And he really didn't. My mind's gone blank. The traitor. Benedict Arnold really won the battle at Saratoga. But Horatio Gates was the commanding officer. He took credit for it. Well, there was a movement after Horatio Gates won the Battle of Saratoga. Gates was trying to get Washington removed as commander of the army. And so Washington, his mama didn't raise no fool either, ships him down to Charlotte and puts him in charge of the Southern Command. Bye, Horatio! So Horatio comes down with his giant ego. And certainly on the list of American military disasters, this would probably be in the top 10. And that's the Battle of Camden. Gates has about 3,000 men, 1,900 casualties. That's a two-thirds casualty rate. His advisors in Charlotte had told him, you don't want to attack that part of the state because there's too many British loyalists there. Yeah, I can do it. March, march, march. So he's marching along, and he sends some of his force out to help Marion and Sumter. So now it's a smaller force, and people are dropping out because it's like really hot and stuff, August in South Carolina. I mean, come on. And so by the time he faces Cornwallis, he's got a smaller force, and then he commits a great blunder. The British regulars are on the British right, and Gates puts untrained, unexperienced militia on his left. So they're facing the British regulars. And the British regulars just slaughtered the militia. And that was pretty much the end of Horatio Gates' career as a military officer. This is also the Battle of Camden. Shows the death of DeKalb or DeKalb, depending on what part of the country you come from. I'm not going to get in the middle of that argument. But he was one of several people who came from Europe, barons and marquises, and you know, along with Lafayette and Rochambeau and others who came to help the colonial cause. Okay, which brings us to the Battle of Kings Mountain. October 7th, troops from North and South Carolina under Colonel Isaac Shelby defeat the British at King's Mountain is one of the turning points of the war. When I give this presentation, anywhere I give it, and I give it all over the country, I always make the statement that the Revolutionary War was won in South Carolina. Now, if I make this statement in South Carolina or Georgia, I see people nodding their heads. I hear people say, yeah, I hear Kings Mountain, Calvin's, Francis Marion, Swamp Fox, Nathaniel Green, and they know exactly what I'm talking about. I gave a presentation 5 miles from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, about 2 years ago. I said the same thing, and I thought they were going to die. They had to call in paramedics and bring oxygen in. They were horrified. They had no idea what I was talking about. And I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I understand why. Because what you were taught in the schools about the Revolutionary War in Pennsylvania, well, it was all New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And after the Battle of Monmouth, which was 1778, well, nothing happened in the war. And then mysteriously, 3 years later, Washington was in Yorktown. So there's this like 3-year gap that we weren't taught anything. Like nothing happened. Well, what happened was the war was being won in South Carolina. So you can see the casualty, British 1,121, Colonials 87. Now, 600 of the Colonial force for the Over the Mountain men from west of the Appalachians, they actually came over the Blue Ridge Mountains and marched down. Some of them were from Virginia also. So why did they get in this fight? They were Scot-Irish farmers. They haven't been involved in this. They got in the fight because of Henry Clinton's Big Mountain. Because Henry Clinton said, any farms we come across, the men on the farm, they're going to have to join the British militia, and if they don't, we're going to burn the farms to the ground. And even though they were over the Appalachians, when they got news of this, they said, yeah, the heck you are, and they all got together, and they marched south from Sycamore Shoals, Tennessee, joined by other troops from North Carolina. You had some troops from Georgia come up, and they all met, and then they attacked the British at Kings Mountain, which is one of the turning points of the war. And this is a painting, a black and white reproduction of a painting called The Gathering of Over Mountain Men in Sycamore Shoals, Tennessee. And it shows the Scot-Irish farmers who are really ticked off by this point. And it shows them getting together at Sycamore Shoals before they march down to South Carolina. This engraving depicts the death of British Major Patrick Ferguson at the Battle of Kings Mountain. Why would the Colonials bother having a painting made of that moment? Probably next to Bernaster Taunton, Patrick Ferguson is the most hated member of the British Army. Why? Well, first off, he was known as the best shot in the British Army, but that's not why they hated him so much. They hated him because Henry Clinton and his big mouth, all that stuff, threats that Henry Clinton made, he put Patrick Ferguson in charge of building the militia up. So Patrick Ferguson would go into little towns, and he would basically impress the local farmers to have to join the British militia. So the Patriot militia really hated him. And supposedly, the story is that he was hit by 7 bullets almost simultaneously. And then this is the moment you see where he's fallen. And we know exactly where he fell. There's a monument at Kings Mountain. So if you want to go and see exactly where the 7 bullets hit him, you can go and see. There's just 2 of the monuments today on Kings Mountain. Another thing that's happening around this time is Bernaster Taunton. If you ever saw the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson, he's the British guy who's such a jerk, Major Tavington. That's based on Taunton. So Lord Cornwallis sends Taunton to search for the Swamp Fox in November 1780. Well, interestingly enough, is Marion gets his nickname that we all know today from none other than Bernaster Taunton. Taunton spent 3 weeks riding around the swamps, never found it. And afterwards, he said he referred to Marion as that damned old fox. So even your worst enemy can give you the best PR, because after that, everybody referred to him not as Francis Marion, but as the Swamp Fox. And some of you may be old enough, I realize not many of you, some of you may be old enough to remember the Disney series in the late 50s and early 60s, starring Leslie Nielsen as Francis Marion. It was all based on the period where Marion was on Snow's Island, using it as his guerrilla base, which started in December 1780. A painting, Marion's Brigade crossing the Peavey River, South Carolina, 1778, on her way to attack the British force under Tarleton. And I don't know what it is about the American Revolution, but it seems when people were on boats crossing rivers, there was always somebody pointing to the shore. I don't know if they really did that or not. Okay. The King's Mountain wasn't enough to convince you that the Revolutionary War was won in South Carolina. From this point on, everything changes because Nathanael Greene is put in charge of the Southern Command. And Washington tells him, "You take orders from no one other than me." He even told him, "If the Congress of the United States tells you to do something, you ask me first." So Greene is given total charge of the Southern Command, and he comes up with a brilliant master plan. The master plan includes capture the fortified British outpost in the interior of the state, Granby, Watson, 96, Orangeburg, and there's some others, and cut off the British supply lines, forcing their retreat to Charleston. And notice there's nothing in here about winning battles. So his strategy is later essentially used by Wayne Tecumseh Sherman when he invades Georgia. That's exactly Sherman's strategy in North Georgia when he attacked. Is he kept losing all these battles, but after every battle, you look at a map and Sherman had advanced 10 miles closer to Atlanta. Well, almost the same thing happened here. Greene lost a series of battles, but after every battle he looked at a map, the British had retreated 20 miles closer to Charleston. It really was a brilliant strategy. Battle of Cowpens, another reason the war was won in South Carolina. On the morning of January 17th, Catherine Moore Barry, also known as Kate Barry, warned the local militia that Banaxter Tarleton was approaching the Cowpens with a large force. And it was told to Brigadier General Daniel Morgan, and he prepared one of the most brilliant strategies in history, and one of the few times that a double envelopment had ever successfully occurred. So, what he did was, he told his militia to go out front. Now, Tarleton's marching toward them. And remember, Tarleton has his ego the size of Manhattan. So, Tarleton's marching toward them. So, Morgan tells the militia, "Okay, I want you to go out front, fire one shot, and then run away." And he said, "I don't want you to retreat in an orderly fashion. I want you to run away because you're just petrified because Tarleton's coming, so just run away." So they did. That's what they do. They go out, they shoot, and they run away, like a Monty Python movie. What they do is, after they run away, they make up this side. The cavalry, under Colonel Washington, no relation, makes up this side, and the Continental Army is right in the center. Tarleton, who thinks he's chasing the militia, comes right into the center of the trap, and he is surrounded both sides, thus a double envelopment. One of the few times in history that that has ever worked successfully. And he just clobbers Carl. There's Colonel William Augustine Washington, the cavalry officer at Cowpens. And that's the U.S. government monument at the battlefield. Now, I put, remember the part about capturing the forts. So the next two were about capturing the forts. This one I specifically put it because, again, the coolness factor of it. So Fort Watson, first off, it's Francis Marion and Henry Lighthorse Harry Lee working together. Now, how many people know who Lighthorse Harry Lee's son is? Robert E. Lee. But just the idea of these two working together, isn't that cool? Swamp, the two guys with the best nickname of the whole war working together, the Swamp Fox and Life Horse Harry Lee. I also throw Mad Anthony Wayne in there for the nickname. So April 16th to 23rd, 1781, they besieged Fort Watson, and the Colonials build a tower to shoot down on Fort Watson. So they build this cool tower. It's called a Mahan Tower after their engineer, Hezekiah Mahan. And so the Colonial snipers are up here. They can shoot down into the fort. Isn't that cool? I mean, it's like something from the Crusades, like the first Crusade when they were attacking Jerusalem. Colonials cut the water supply, but the British are clever. They dig a well. So finally, April 23rd, Marion and Lighthorse Harry Lee assault the fort with help from the snipers in the Macon Tower, and Fort Watson falls. April 25th, 1781, the British retain the field, but later retreat from nearby Camden at the Battle of Hot Crooks Hill. Once again, Greene loses the battle, but what happens? A week later, British retreat. This was an unfortunate loss because Greene actually had high ground. He had Hot Crooks Hill, and Camden was a very fortified city. So Greene never expected the British to come out from the fortified city to attack him. And that's exactly what happened. Lord Francis Rawdon came out from the city gates. He attacked Greene's left, and Greene had to pull back. But again, the British had to retreat because Greene had cut off their supply line. Now this one's fun. May 15, 1781, Lighthorse Harry Lee seizes Fort Granby, South Carolina, not too far from here. But instead of actually fighting a battle or shooting or any of that kind of stuff, he sends a messenger into the guy who's running Fort Granby. He says, "I'm a good deal. If you surrender the fort, I'll let you and your officers leave with all of your personal belongings." So I guess for reply back, does that include all our furniture? Yeah, sure. They call the furniture. So this wagon train appears with divans and love seats and whatever else the British had. Going down the road, they were technically prisoners of war, but they were simply escorted back to the British lines. And then Lighthorse Liar Harry Lee walked into the fort. Didn't shoot a single bullet. June 18, 1781, British supposedly defeat Nathaniel Greene at the siege of 96. Greene had set up a pretty intricate siege. They were even digging a tunnel underneath it to, you know, try to blow it up. But unfortunately, as the siege wore on, Greene gets word that Sir Francis Rawdon, the same guy who beat him into Hot Crooks Hill, was coming with a force of 2,000 from Charleston as reinforcements. So Greene decided, well, I got to attack. I can't wait for the siege to play out. He did attack. He was beaten back. But guess what? The British retreated soon after because Greene cut off their supply line. And that's what it looks like today. And then the final battle, so you know I'm getting near the end here. So the final battle in South Carolina is Eutaw Springs. Sometimes also known as the Battle of the Yams, because Greene's forces surprised a British patrol who were trying to dig sweet potatoes out of the ground. But since September 8th, Greene's forces met the British under Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Stewart, and it's a pretty even battle. It was the British lines, and they kind of went back and forth. Finally, the British come back to this brick house here on the plantation. Greene's men came forward and started shooting at the house with cannon, but unfortunately, along the way, some of his men stopped at a British camp so that they could ransack the stuff that was in the tents, which probably didn't help. So the British actually came out and attacked and got hold of Greene's artillery, so Greene finally put back. But so I guess you can say the British won the Battle of Utah Springs, except the fact that they had to retreat afterwards because their supply line had been cut off. You have a little more respect for Nathaniel Greene now? I mean, I tell people all the time, greatest general of war was Washington, but number two was Nathaniel Greene. I mean, the guy was just fantastic. Here's a couple prints. You can see the house that the British were in. That's Nathaniel Greene urging his men forward. And a closer view, here's the colonials attacking the British who are in the house. And it's not a big battlefield, but it's very quiet. It's very nice. And there's this big monument there and a few smaller monuments. October 19th, 1781, British troops under Lord Cornwallis surrendered to troops under George Washington at Yorktown, Virginia. And as I said earlier, Lord Cornwallis was too chicken poop to come out and do the surrender himself, so he gave the sword to one of his underlings, and his underling brought it out to hand it to Washington, and Washington said, I'm not taking it from no underling. So he indicated Benjamin Lincoln, and the surrender sword was given to Benjamin Lincoln. December 14, 1782, the British abandoned Charleston. It was quickly occupied by Nathaniel Greene's forces. And September 3, 1783, Treaty of Paris officially ends the Revolutionary War. Now remember, this presentation was an overview, so if I didn't get your favorite battle in it or in enough detail, it was meant to be an overview. So, any questions, comments, or if I said anything that really offended anybody, any rebels?
No questions? Come on. This group's usually four questions.
I will say this, everybody's awake, though. I mean, I just had dinner, and everybody's still awake. So I take that as a personal view.
How much of the Continental Army did you ever
in South Carolina? Certainly under 10,000, but it was certainly in the thousands.
Were there South Carolinians in it, or was it?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking how many Continental Army was in South Carolina. Yes, there were, but most of the South Carolina forces were in the militia, because Washington sent the Continental Army down from Pennsylvania and New Jersey and New York, just like I said in the beginning. Was there another?
Where's Granby?
Just below Columbia.
Columbia.
One of the suburbs.
Casey.
You know where the Olympia neighborhood is? Yeah. Okay, well, right across from there, across from there.
It's Granby. I mean, I don't think there's a town there anymore.
No.
No.
The town's built up.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's a year between Yorktown and
Treaty,
almost a year.
Oh, the Treaty, yes.
Wasn't this the period when there were lots of little skirmishes
between
the Loyalists and the
Patriots? Yes. It's unfortunate that it took that long to officially end the war. But as soon as the ink was dry on the paper, the Patriots, the Colonials, and almost every colony now state immediately seized as much land from the Tory forces as possible and kicked them out of the country. Some of them went to Nova Scotia, some of them went to England. So,
can you talk just a little bit about residents of the colony or residents of South Carolina who initially allied with the Loyalist forces but then switched to the Patriot cause? And can you estimate a round percentage about how many did that?
I think there's a key factor here, and that key factor is whether they were forced to be Loyalist militia or not. And if we're talking about people who were forced to be Loyalist militia, I would say well over 50% eventually escaped and went to fight with the Colonials. As far as if you take the force element out of it, there's probably 30-40% of South Carolina is staunchly Loyalist. And when Cornwallis showed up, they were they did sign up to fight them, so. Mary?
How did the militia interact with the Continental Army, and what was the role of the two?
Well, in all wars, the volunteer army, militia, whatever you want to call them, home guard, are often treated as second-class citizens by the regulars. And I think some of that occurred here, but there were situations where the militia outfought the Continentals, and Kings Mountain is the obvious example, where most of these guys were frontiersmen. But, you know what kind of rifles they brought from over the mountain? The Pennsylvania rifle, the one that Daniel Boone used to carry. They were long-distance hunting rifles, and that's what they brought with them. And the British had the Brown Bess, is that what they called it? And a Pennsylvania rifle could shoot a deer at 300 yards, three football fields, and the Brown Bess, I could point at you and shoot, and you'd probably be there afterwards. So I think in general, if you're better trained and better equipped, you're going to do better on the battlefield, but I don't think we can assume that the militia wasn't effective. For example, Francis Marion, too, those were all volunteers. Those weren't members of the Continental Army. So I think probably South Carolina, more than anywhere else, the militia really proved itself.
So you mentioned that about a duel in Georgia, correct? Well, so to explain part of this is Gadsden had his own duel with Lincoln, did he not?
With Benjamin Lincoln.
Yeah, Benjamin Lincoln. Is that not true? I mean, that was a conflict between who's in charge.
I'm not familiar that they actually went as far as to have a duel.
Gadsden shot in the air.
Okay.
Lincoln missed.
In the case of Lachlan McIntosh and Buck Gwinnett, neither of them missed.
Yeah.
It's just McIntosh hit him right in the heart.
That's why his autograph is so rare.
You can thank Lachlan McIntosh for making Buck Gwinnett's autograph so expensive. Well, hearing no others, I'll leave you with one thought. Please buy my books. I'll be here as we're getting done here, but I'll also be here tomorrow at 8:30. Mark.
Thank you very much, Robert. This is a big name.